From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Stoicism. You know, the ancient school of philosophy, the Stoics. And there's a chance you have a misimpression about Stoicism, that it's about being dour or disengaged. Well, the philosopher Massimo Pigliucci says that's not what it means to be a Stoic. In fact, he says it's about being mindful and just not getting freaked out about the stuff you can't control. He'll join us to explain how to be a Stoic after this.
Every day, the stories you hear on KUER are fair, calm, and informative. We find stories that affect you and your community. We take the time to explain and analyze, to ask more questions and find more answers. KUER is the public radio station that works for you. But to do that, we need your financial support. Help us kick off our upcoming fall fund drive by making a contribution today. Go to KUER.org and click donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you were to come up with one essential question for your life, what would it be? One question that gets at all the things you worry about or wonder about, like suffering, like love, like death. The philosopher Massimo Pigliucci says, in every culture we know of, there is one central question that comes up time and time again. How do you lead a life worth living? All the religions, all the philosophers have taken a shot at it, but for Pigliucci, the most satisfying take has come from Stoicism. You probably know the basics: pragmatism, self-restraint, control. In his book, Pigliucci explores Stoicism, but suggests that this ancient philosophy can be used to live a modern life. His book is called How to Be a Stoic. Pigliucci is a professor of philosophy at the City University of New York. He blogs at PlatoFootnote.org and HowToBeAStoic.org. He joined us from the studios of the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism in New York City. So how to explain his interest in Stoicism? Well, aside from being a philosopher and a biologist, Pigliucci also happens to be a Roman. So he says this is in his cultural DNA.
That's right. I grew up in Rome, and I lived there for 26 years before moving to the United States. When I was a child, I was, you know, walking down to the Roman Forum or the Colosseum. But also, I studied Roman history in junior high school. And in high school, I studied philosophy for 3 years, which is mandatory in Italy, and that includes ancient Greek and Roman philosophy. So I did, and also I studied Latin. So I translated Seneca, for instance, one of the Stoics. So in a sense, it was very familiar. But the interesting thing to me, at least, or the surprising thing to me, is that all of that had been sort of pushed in the background. And after I left high school, it really never occurred to me that that kind of stuff could come back to me, you know, literally decades later.
Right.
And so it changed my life.
What was the thing? I'm not sure if this is a simplistic way of putting it, but what is the thing that troubled you, that made you look to the Stoics? Was there some kind of question? I know there's a big question at the heart of all of this, but was there something you were working out that led you there?
The fundamental question was, what do I want to do with the rest of my life and why?
Yeah.
And this is, of course, a question that, you know, occasionally at least one asks himself or herself at different stages, and I had asked myself before. And I've given myself different answers because it depends on the life stage where you are and what your current interests are and so on and so forth. Ever since leaving Catholicism back when I was in high school, that question has always been kind of at the back of my mind. Mm-hmm. And I've explored a number of different ways to answer it. For a number of years, I considered myself a secular humanist, for instance. Mm-hmm. And that was good enough of a philosophy. It gave me a sort of a general compass, because that's what a philosophy of life really does. It gives you a compass that allows you to navigate life, both in terms of meaning and behavior and expectations and things like that. It's pretty much what a religion does as well. In fact, all religions come with a philosophy of life embedded into them.
Well, this leads to something you write about in the book. You, as you said, you left organized religion, Catholicism, years ago, but you say in the book that you have this affinity for people who live secular lives, but you also, on this, at the same time, came to be really disenchanted with this new atheist movement. Talk a little bit about that, because it seems like trying to find the middle ground in between this kind of dismissive nature of religion or the supernatural on one hand, and then the other side being too mystical, being too caught up with the supernatural was also bothering you. So it seems like you were trying to find the middle, a middle way in some ways.
Yes, that is true. Although it's a middle way, not in a sort of a metaphysical sense, but in the sense of an attitude, right? So I do consider myself an atheist, and I understand that word as to literally mean atheist. That is, I lack a positive belief in theism, in God. So I don't know that there is no God, but what I do think is that I don't have sufficient reasons or evidence to believe that there is one.
Right.
That said, however, it seems to me that the proper attitude toward religion, in particular, but also in general toward sort of people's beliefs, is one of respect. Depending on how the different polls in different countries, but you know, like something like 80 or 90% of people globally believe in some kind of God, and to dismiss all of them as a bunch of idiots just doesn't seem very helpful. And it doesn't seem a good way to think about other people and their beliefs. So I understand where they're coming from. But it seems to me that the whole point of being a secular person is precisely that you're trying to exercise both reason and, I think, compassion toward other people. And so that to dismiss others, especially billions of others, literally, as a bunch of bumbling idiots, it just doesn't seem very, very good attitude.
You chose, as you say in the book, you decided not to choose secular humanism or secular Buddhism. Those paths weren't satisfactory to you either. Buddhism, you said, maybe was a little too mystical for your taste. Secular humanism, kind of too dependent on this modern concept of rationality. So what is it that Stoicism offered that was different from all of those?
Look, if somebody were to push me, I would still say, yeah, pretty much I'm a secular humanist,
right.
Meaning that
right.
If that's one of the choices, that probably does still come pretty close to give you a pretty good idea of what I think, meaning that I am secular, so I'm not a religious person, mm-hmm. and I'm a humanist, meaning that I'm interested in humanistic values.
Sure.
Such as, you know, democracy, equality, and things like that. So, but the problem with secular humanism as a philosophy of life, that it always struck me as a little bit of a hazard thing. And I like think that, you know, sort of a list of things that I like that are put together without necessarily much of a sort of a coherent general understanding or general theory of what a philosophy is. Stoicism, on the other hand, and of course Stoicism is not the only example of that kind of philosophy, but Stoicism in particular struck me, on the other hand, as a system that was well thought out. You can, you know, criticize certain parts of it. You can, in fact, reject certain parts of it. But still, it's a coherent view of what a human life is and, more importantly, what a human life ought to be. And that coherence struck me as really appealing. Even in the parts where I disagree, for instance, the ancient Stoics were pantheists. They believed that the universe is a living organism, and basically that's what they called God, right? As a modern scientist, I don't subscribe to that sort of metaphysical view. In my mind, the universe is just it's a collection of things and processes that is regulated by the laws of nature. But I can negotiate with the ancient Stoics on some points, like this one that I just mentioned, and still retain an overall sense of a beautiful, coherent way of thinking about life that I find particularly satisfying. And it was hard for me to find something like that in secular humanism.
Yeah. It's interesting. It seems like one of the things that has interested you is because this philosophical framework – which combines these, as you put it in the book, these ancient ethical concepts with a modern concept of what we now know about nature in general and human nature as well. So the combination of those things, an ancient philosophical framework with a kind of a modern what take or update seems to interest you?
I find it interesting that a lot of people ask me, oh, why would you find useful a philosophy that originated, you know, 24 centuries ago? And I said, well, couldn't you ask the same about Buddhism or Taoism or Christianity or, you know, pretty much any other philosophy or religion in the world, you know, with very few exceptions? So it's a kind of a strange question, right? So obviously, if people do find something useful for more than two millennia, well, there's got to be something to it. Now, that something to it, it doesn't lie necessarily in the ancient understanding of how the world works. Right. Obviously, we've made a hell of a lot of progress in the meantime. You know, modern science is very different and it's much more accurate, as far as we can tell, than whatever you know, Seneca or Marcus Aurelius knew or thought they knew. But what makes these things, not just Stoicism, but in general ancient philosophies and religions, still very much current today is that their focus wasn't really on the metaphysics. Metaphysics was kind of incidental. I mean, they had to come up with some kind of story or explanation for how the world works. The important thing was the ethics. And the ethics in ancient times meant not just what it means today. Today, it mostly means, you know, the study of the difference between right and wrong. The ancients, when they used the word ethics, meant the way you live your life. So ethics is the study of how to live your life in order to make the best out of it.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing is obviously being relevant for, you know, two millennia. People want to know. People want to reflect, occasionally reflect on what they're doing and why. And they want to have some ideas of why it is that they're living the life that they're living.
Habits and customs. Connecting habits and customs with morality and ethics, basically.
That's right.
Yeah.
And in fact, the word ethics in Greek actually that basically meant habits and customs.
Yeah.
And was translated as by Cicero in Latin as moralis, which is the root of our word morality. And it had a similar, very similar meaning.
The garden is a good metaphor. You mentioned, you know, this need to nurture the soil, the need to fence off the garden. And also, I have to say, this idea that and this seems, I have to say, in some ways pretty Christian, the idea of by their fruits they shall know them. It's something that Jesus said.
Right.
I'm not sure he was much of a Stoic, and maybe we can get to that later. But maybe you could say something about that garden metaphor, which I found useful.
Yeah, the garden metaphor is due to Chrysippus, who was the third head of the Stoa. The Stoa was the name by which the ancient Stoic school was known. And in fact, the name itself comes from the Stoa Poikile, which means painted porch,
right.
Because the original Stoics met in public public market known as the painted porch in Athens. Now, Chrysippus was trying to explain why is it that a typical Stoic curriculum, so let's say you decide to go to Stoic school, you know, 2300 years ago in ancient Athens, and you say, well, what am I going to study in Stoic school? And you were studying, going to study three things. They called them the logic, the physics, and the ethics. But those three words add a much broader meanings from what they have today. By logic, they also meant an understanding of the human mind and an understanding of good reasoning. By physics, they meant not just what we mean by that term, so the study of the, you know, basics, basic structure of the natural world, but basically everything that we today call natural science.
Mm-hmm.
So biology, physics, chemistry, geology, the whole thing. Now, why would you want to study those other two if the most important thing to do was to understand ethics, that is, how to live your life? That's where the metaphor of the garden comes in. It's nice. So for a Chrysippus, the garden is fenced. When you have a garden, you want to fence it because you don't want the weeds and the bad stuff to get in. In the metaphor, the fence is the logic. That is, sound reasoning is what allows you to discriminate what's good and what is not good and what is acceptable from what is not acceptable. Once you're inside the garden, in order to produce the flowers and fruits of the garden, that would be the ethics. That would be, you know, your a good life. You need nurture, and that nurturing comes from the soil and the water that you use in order to grow your plants. That soil, that rich soil, is the physics. That is, it's the understanding of the world. And the reasoning there is that unless you understand at least to some extent how the world works, you're going to be under very, you know, misleading impressions, and you're likely to make very bad decisions about how to live your life.
Right. I wanted to back up a bit and just talk a little bit about some of the misconceptions of what it means to be a Stoic. Because yes, there are so many. I guess the common perception is that Stoics are Mr. Spock, right? They suppress mm-hmm. their emotions. And I guess Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, he creates Mr. Spock based on, I guess, this misimpression of what Stoicism yep. is.
That's right. And which is really too bad because Mr. Spock is one of my favorite characters of all time.
yeah.
but unfortunately, Gene Roddenberry did not do much of a background research. And, you know, there was no Wikipedia at the time, so he couldn't check it.
Yeah.
And so what he did, basically, he confused the word Stoic with a capital S, which refers to the philosophy, with the modern word Stoic with a little s, mm-hmm. which means an attitude of going through life with a stiff upper lip and suppressing your emotions. Which, of course, is exactly what Spock tries to do, at least.
Yeah.
He doesn't necessarily succeed, but tries to do that. So it is not true that the Stoics try to suppress the emotion, and it's certainly not true that they try to go through life with stiff upper lip. But it is true that they try to redirect their emotions,
yeah.
and I'll explain in a second what that means. And also it's true that one of their attempts was to improve their ability to endure negative circumstances. Mm-hmm. So and because they thought that life is going to throw stuff at you that you're not going to like. And so they referred often to this to the training that they were doing in order to endure stuff as winter training, as soldiers, you know, ancient Roman soldiers were doing in the middle of the winter. They were preparing for the battles to be fought in the spring and in the summer. Mm. And that's the same idea, that you prepare for adversity in life because adversity is going to come one time or another in one way or another. And so you want to be prepared. You don't want to be surprised. But back to the emotion stuff. So the Stoics made some interesting distinctions about the emotions. They thought that fully formed emotions are the result of a cognitive judgment. That is, they result from our agreeing or disagreeing with certain assumptions. But they also thought that there were some automatic sort of feelings that you cannot avoid. So let me give an example. Let's say that I'm sleeping at night in my apartment and I hear a sudden noise and I get scared. I get this rush of adrenaline, right? Yeah. The rush of adrenaline is an inevitable feeling. There's nothing you can do to control it. It's just comes with being an animal of a particular type. Yeah. And the Stoics didn't even think about controlling that one. It's like, okay, well, that's – sure, that happens. That's your first reaction. However, if I then start thinking, oh, my gosh, there's burglars in the house. I got to get up because they want to kill me or something like that. Now I'm actually adding cognitive content to my initial reaction. And now I'm becoming afraid in the fully formed sense of the emotion. Now I'm scared, not just because I'm reacting to an external stimulus, but because I'm actually thinking about things going in a certain direction. Hmm. And what the Stoics thought was that what you need to do is to be very careful in using your judgment. Once you have an initial feeling, the one that you cannot control, they call it a proto-pateia, a proto-emotion, or a pre-emotion kind of thing. Once you have that, and that is inevitable, you're going to have it as a human being, then it's up to you, however, to arrive at the best possible judgment. Is this something really that I should be afraid of? Or in fact, the more likely explanation is that my cat once again, is making a mess in the kitchen and that's where the noise is coming from.
Right.
So the idea was to make this judgment. And therefore, that means if you do make that judgment, that means you're in a certain sense responsible for your emotions. And in particular, you're responsible for moving away your emotions from a negative and disruptive one, such as fear, anger, hatred, and things like that, and instead cultivating positive and constructive, healthy emotions, such as love and joy and a sense of justice and things like that.
That's Massimo Piliucci. He's a professor of philosophy at the City University of New York. His book is called How to Be a Stoic, Using Ancient Philosophy to Live a Modern Life. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
They say all politics is local, and KUER reporters are here to bring you Utah stories, news that affects you here at home, like public lands and water issues, religion, and the tech boom. You can trust KUER to bring you the facts and thoughtful analysis of why the story matters.
Listen to KUER on air at 90.1, stream us at KUER.org, and here's a pro tip. If you've got a smart speaker, tell it you want to listen to NPR, and Alexa or Google will take you right there.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Stoicism with the philosopher Massimo Piliucci. In his book, Piliucci explores how to be a Stoic. That's the name of the book. Using ancient philosophy to live a modern life. It seems like at the heart of any worldview or philosophy or religion is what we're supposed to do about the inevitability of death. Mm-hmm. One thing you mentioned in your book is that Stoicism probably speaks most convincingly to this big question.
They do. They're not the only ones. Epicurus does a good job as well. In fact, the Epicurean argument is very, very similar to the Stoic argument about death. So for the Stoics, death is an inevitable part of life. It just is. It just happens. You know, it's a natural process. We're born, we grow up, we experience certain things, and at some point we die. That implies two things for the Stoics. One is that, well, if it's inevitable, then why are you worrying about it?
Right.
It's like it's going to happen. And sure, what you want to do is probably to postpone it as much as is reasonable to do so. What you want to do is probably try to get to that point as prepared as possible, you know, hopefully avoiding a painful process or painful and long process and all that sort of stuff. But ultimately, we are all going to get there. And so there's not much point in worrying about death itself, particularly because the Stoics thought, remember that the Stoics were materialists. They thought that everything is made of matter,
yeah,
including what they call our soul, which we would really translate more likely to our sort of cognitive faculties. And so they thought that once we're dead, there's nothing there. We don't experience anything.
Yeah.
And so Seneca says very clearly, just like Epicurus does, why are you worried about something you're not going to experience? When death is here, you're not, and yeah, vice versa. When you're here, death is not. Now that's the sort of the negative part of it. Like, you know, don't worry about it. But there is a positive aspect which I find very clear in the Stoics, much more clear in the Stoics than in many other philosophies that I've studied. And that is, okay, now that we agree that death is a natural process, it's inevitable, and all that, and you don't need to worry about it. What are you going to do with the rest of your life?
Right.
Because you know it's coming. And incidentally, you don't know when it's coming, right? I mean, we all have expectations about our lifespan, right? So, right now, if I'm a white male in the Western world, my life expectancy is about, you know, 75, 77 or something like that, depending on details. But that's only statistically speaking. I could die today.
Right.
I could, you know, walk out of this studio, and then a crazy car hits me on the sidewalk, and that's it, and done. I don't know that. I hope not, obviously, but I don't know that. So the Stoics counseled to constantly keep in mind this thing that you don't have any idea how much longer you have. But this was meant not as a counsel for, you know, sort of brooding about your death. Oh my gosh, today might be the last day. But rather as an exercise in focusing your mind. And also in thankfulness. So Seneca says, you know, every day that I get up in the morning, I say, oh, thank God, I'm going to get another one to play with, another day to play with. And then you ask yourself, well, what are you doing? Marcus Aurelius, who was a Roman emperor in the second century and one of the major Stoics, constantly writes in his diary, which has come to us as the Meditations, mm-hmm. He asks himself, so what did you do today? You know, what kind of good things did you do today? The worst answer that a Stoic can get at the end of the day to the question of what did you do today is, well, not much. Because that means you just wasted another day of your life without contributing to the rest of society without doing anything useful. So thinking about death, it's a way to focusing on what it is that you want to do and why.
Yeah. Is there a dimension of being aware? Mindful seems to be the word of the moment. But you say that being a Stoic is about, as you put it, practicing virtue, navigating the world while being mindful of the moral dimensions of our actions.
Right. So
part of this is about – meditation is a practice you write about and some spiritual exercises, which I hope we can get to in a little bit later in the program. But this idea of awareness seems important.
Yes. Now, when people use the word mindfulness, typically in the Western world, at least, what comes to mind is a sort of a Zen exercise from Buddhism. That's not what stoic mindfulness is about, although there are other schools of Buddhism, because Buddhism is, in fact, a very diverse kind of, you know, philosophy and religion. It has been in existence for 2.5 millennia, so it's diversified enormously. Mm-hmm. And some sections of Buddhism, some ways of practicing Buddhism are actually very similar to Stoicism. There's a lot of similarities between Buddhism, Stoicism, and Taoism, as it turns out, in terms of the practice and in terms of the ethics, not in terms of the metaphysics. The metaphysics are very different.
Yeah.
Now, as far as a Stoic is concerned, mindfulness means literally paying attention to things. In particular, as you just mentioned, paying attention to the ethical dimension of things. Now, this may seem like a big thing to do, but in fact, you have constant opportunities throughout your day. You know, I'm a teacher, so I have opportunities constantly to interact with my students, you know, every day. Well, the way in which I interact with my students, those are ethical occasions, you know, ethical moments, because I need to be mindful of the fact that even though there is a certain relationship between us, you know, these are human beings, they're here to learn something. It is my job to facilitate that learning and so on and so forth. If I deviate from any of those expectations or any of those reminders, I'm not being mindful about my role toward them. And then I might see a friend for a drink before going home. Now, a friend is a different kind of relationship, but it also has an ethical dimension. You know, there's certain expectations. If my friend comes to me with something that is burdening him, I'm not supposed to sort of broadcast it on Twitter. You know, in fact, on the contrary, I'm supposed to give him advice, maybe even advice that it's hard to take. If that is the case, then I go home and I go home and I see my partner or my daughter or something like that. And there are, you know, different relationships that have different expectations and so on and so forth. Everything that we do during it, almost everything we do during a day has an ethical dimension to which the Stoics wants to be mindful. The idea here is not to go around every day, spending every waking moment by, you know, worrying about everything that is wrong in the world, because that would paralyze you. All it means is that from time to time, at least, we really ought to pay attention. It's not like you have a difficult conversation with your friends every time you go out for a drink and so on and so forth. But when you do, then you be mindful of what your role is within that situation. What is the best thing you can do to handle it?
I have to say, one of the stories that I really liked, you tell this anecdote. You were in Turkey. And you had gone out to dinner, and there were these people there, young people, I think it was, they were on their phones. And you just sort of made this snap judgment, or had the impulse to make this snap judgment about these just a bunch of dope kids who are not paying attention to each other. They've given into technology. But what turns out what they were actually doing is they were looking at – there was a coup d'etat or an attempted coup d'etat in 2016, and they were looking at the news. I mean, this was really important. But I think that was an interesting moment for me, because this is one of these areas of study for the Stoics, this idea of not judging and how to best react to a situation. This idea of judgment was important. Talk a little bit about this, if you would.
Yeah, we're prone to make that kind of sort of snap judgment about other people. And of course, in that particular case, I failed as well. But one of the things that Stoicism does teach you, Stoicism is a very forgiving and self-forgiving sort of philosophy. You're not supposed to make judgments about other people, because most of the times you don't know enough about them.
Exactly.
And which turned out to be the case in that particular instance you were talking about. Most of the times you don't know enough, and even when you think you know enough, there's probably a more charitable interpretation. And certainly the worst possible interpretation is not helpful. So the standard Stoic exercise in that case is to try to rephrase to yourself the situation in neutral terms. So Epictetus was one of the major Stoic writers. He started his life actually as a slave, and then he became eventually one of the most famous teachers of the ancient world.
And we should mention he's the guide throughout the book. He's important to you, and he's the Stoic who guides us through these principles in the book. Anyway, sorry.
That's right. He's my personal guide.
Yeah.
And so Epictetus at one point tells his students, he says, look, Don't say that somebody is, you know, bathing badly. Just say that he's bathing in a way that you don't do it normally. Don't say that somebody is drinking too much, because you don't know what too much is for them. Just say, you know, he's drinking a certain amount, and so on and so forth. And so once you do that, once you start getting into the habit of doing that, it's kind of refreshing, because you don't, you know, you see yourself not jumping to immediate judgment, the snap judgment. And actually, your own life improved. First of all, you improve your relationships with others. Because, you know, let's be frank, nobody likes somebody who judges you all the time.
Yeah.
Or even some of the time. Nobody right. likes to be judged.
Right.
But so it tends to improve your relationship with others. But especially, I think, it improves what Marcus Aurelius would refer to as the color of your soul. Your soul is colored, is dyed, he says, by the colors of your thoughts. And so if you alter your thoughts through exercise and to be mindful about the way you think about things, then gradually, by habit, you know, your soul actually becomes a little clearer and not as dirty as it was originally. So that, to me, was an interesting exercise, a reminder of the Stoic approach on judgment. The other thing that reminded me, of course, is a fundamental concept in Stoicism, which is the dichotomy of control.
Yeah.
This is the idea which is prominent, especially in Epictetus, but it actually goes back to the beginning of the philosophy by Zeno of Citium, who was a Phoenician merchant who in around 300 BCE actually got the whole thing started.
Yeah.
The dichotomy of control basically is this. Like Epictetus says, look, some things are up to us and other things are not up to us. And the things that are up to us are pretty reduced in number. They essentially come down to your judgments and your intentions. And other than that, you know, pretty much everything else you don't control.
Right.
Now, not controlling doesn't mean you don't affect it or you don't influence it. There are certain things that you neither control, obviously, nor influence, like the weather.
Yeah.
But we usually don't worry too much about those. There's a large number of things that you influence but you don't control, including things that most of us are under the mistaken impression that we actually do control. Like, for instance, you know, my body or my reputation or my wealth or things like that. And that is actually not true. I mean, I influence the my body in the sense that I can take care of it. I can go to the gym and I can try to eat healthy and so on and so forth. But then, you know, a virus strikes. In fact, when I was writing the book, an intestinal virus struck me, and there was nothing I could do about it. It's, you know, I had done everything I could in order to take care of my body, and then my body just betrayed me, and I had a miserable 48 hours.
Right.
That was a very good reminder that you don't control even that kind of stuff. Your reputation, well, you can work on your reputation, right? You can try to be a good person and, you know, do the right thing and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, it's not ultimately entirely up to you. Somebody can slander you. Something can happen that can be misunderstood by other people. All sorts of stuff can happen and your reputation can be ruined. So all of these things you don't control ultimately. Then what do you do? The idea is of the Stoics is then you focus your attention on the things you control completely.
Right.
And those, again, are your judgments and your decisions. And then you take the rest as with equanimity. Mm-hmm. There's this beautiful example, this beautiful metaphor that the Stoics use. Actually, this comes from Cicero, but it is a classic Stoic who was not a Stoic, but he was sympathetic to Stoicism. And he uses the metaphor of an archer trying to hit an enemy soldier. And he says, look, what is it that it's up to the archer? First of all, to exercise, to try over and over to play with his bows and his arrows, to do what I was referring to earlier, basically, as winter training. You prepare for the occasion before the occasion comes. Then what is up to him is also the choice of the arrows, the care of the bow. It's the aiming as best as he can, is being as focused as he can until it lets the arrow go. But once the arrow goes, that's it. You don't control anything at all. Whether you hit the target or not depends, of course, in part on your efforts, but it also depends on other things. The enemy soldier may turn at the last moment, see the arrow coming and duck.
Yeah.
Or a gust of wind might be coming in the middle and your best shot is completely wasted. What do you do in that case? And Cicero says, as this beautiful turn of phrase says, well, hitting the target is to be preferred but not to be desired.
Right.
Meaning that, you know, yeah, of course you want to hit the target. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
But if you don't, you say, well, sometimes you hit the target, sometimes you don't. I'll try again next time.
Yeah.
And that was a reminder, you know, that situation you're talking about during the coup d'etat or attempted coup d'etat in Turkey, that was definitely a clear reminder of the dichotomy of control. Mm. There was nothing we could do about the big situation. We could only make decisions instantly, locally on, okay, what are we going to do next? We're going to try to get back to the hotel. All right, can we do that? Well, let's see. Let's find out what's the best way to do that. The big picture was completely out of our hands.
Yeah.
Totally.
Maybe this is related, but you also write that one of the key tenets of Stoicism is coming to terms with the things we can and cannot master.
Yeah.
Say something about that.
Yes. So the idea – so there is a modern Stoic. His name is Lawrence Baker, and he wrote a really, really – he's a philosopher, and he wrote a really, really good book, although it's a pretty difficult book to read, unfortunately. But it's called A New Stoicism. And in fact, if your listeners wants to take a look at the book, I have a number of posts and my blog, which is howtobeastoic.org, which are commentaries on Larry's book.
Yeah.
Now, Larry – has this interesting notion of what he calls the axiom of futility. And the axiom of futility that he thinks is sort of part of a modern Stoic outlook essentially says this: look, when you have a project, when you think that you're going to do something or you want to do something, you want to accomplish something, ask yourself, what is the proportion between your actual means and your actual abilities and what you want to do? And if it is possible, of course, try to do it. If it is unlikely, be careful about partitioning your efforts accordingly, and especially your hopes accordingly. But if it is impossible, if it's clear to you that that's just not going to be possible, then don't try, because you're just wasting precious time and energy and so on and so forth. Now, lots of people, when they hear that, say, oh, but if people didn't try the impossible, we would never have progress, we would, et cetera, et cetera. And that kind of response is kind of misunderstanding the point. First of all, if people the very phrase "if people didn't try the impossible, we wouldn't make progress" is literally nonsensical, because clearly, if people succeeded, this was not impossible.
Right.
So it's a question of judgment, right? But really, most of the time, this applies to very mundane situations. Like, let's say right now I'm 54. I like soccer. But if I were to decide, oh, yeah, you know what? I really like soccer. I'm going to become a soccer star. I'm going to play for the Serie A, the Italian Major League. That would be stupid of me.
Right.
Because at 54, with the physical abilities that I have, with the fact that I never actually trained professionally for soccer and so on and so forth, that would simply be stupid. That would not be a good investment of my time, resources, energies, and so on and so forth. So that's what the axiom of futility is really about. It's like, okay, you have a certain limited amount of time, resources, energy, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Where are you going to use them? What are you going to do with them? And what are your expectations about whether you succeed or not?
You write this in the book: just as for the Stoics, death itself is what gives urgent meaning to life, the possibility of leaving life voluntarily gives us the courage to do what is right under otherwise unbearable circumstances. And this idea of the morality of suicide you write mm-hmm. about. Would you talk a little bit about this? Epictetus wrote about, which I thought so beautifully, this idea of the door being open.
Right. Yeah. So the Stoics talked a lot about suicide, and they clearly thought that it was acceptable, but only under extreme circumstances.
Yeah.
And in fact, Epictetus himself explains very well this concept. So he uses uses this analogy of the open door. He says to one of his students, "Look, if the room that you're in it's smoky, there's a lot of smoke, you can't breathe, then get out. The door is open. You can just walk through the door. But so long as you decide to stay, that means the room is not smoky enough. You can still breathe. You can still do something about it."
Yeah.
What's the point of the analogy? The idea is that suicide is a guarantor of freedom. In fact, Seneca says that freedom is as far away, as close to you as your wrists,
yeah.
as in, slitting them.
Right.
Well, why would you say something like that? Because the idea is that you always have a way out. If you really absolutely think that the circumstances require it, then there is a way out. And, you can just say, okay, that's it. It's my life. It's going to be my decision. But what that does is, again, just like thinking about death is not an excuse for not doing anything. In fact, it's the opposite. It's the reason that pushes you forward to make the best of what you have. The same idea is a very similar idea. It's about suicide. Yeah, suicide is your way out. But since you don't presumably want to take the way out unless the circumstances are really exceptional, really extreme, then the next question is, how are you going to deal with the circumstances you actually find yourself in? Epictetus in the Discourses has an interesting case where a student tells him that a close friend of his is decided to commit suicide by starvation, which was pretty common at the time.
Yeah.
And Epictetus' first reaction is, oh, my gosh, he's my friend. I better go to him and see if I can help him. So he goes to his friend and he says, you know, what happened? I hear that you decided to starve yourself. You know, tell me what happened. And if it is the right thing to do, I will help you. You know, we're here. We're your friends. We'll stay with you until the end and we'll provide you with whatever you need. And his friend says, well, I'm doing it because I said I was going to do it. And Epictetus stops in his tracks and then says, what are you doing, fool? You don't do something like that just because you said you were going to do it. This is not a reason to commit suicide. It's not a reason to do anything. You know, if it's a serious reason, sure, we'll be with you. This is because this is your ticket to freedom, to free yourself from whatever unbearable situation you have. But that situation has to be unbearable. If it isn't, if it is just a bet, or if it's just a, you know, to honor your word because you said you were doing it, that's just foolish. And Epictetus, by the way, doesn't mince words. I mean, he called some of his friends and his students, you know, you fools or you slaves, which he uses metaphorically,
of course,
as in, you know, slave to your passions or to your, you know, bad thinking. But of course, it's particularly interesting because that comes from an ex-slave himself, right? An actual ex-slave. So suicide is. For the Stoics, is a way out, but only to be taken under extreme circumstances. And
let
it is a guarantor of freedom.
Let me quote Epictetus, because I love – this was one of my favorite parts of this section. Stay where you are and depart not without reason.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, that's from that episode. Yes.
Yeah.
And exactly. So you have to have a reason, and it better be a good reason, a strong reason, because otherwise you're just playing and you're not taking seriously – your role in society, you're not taking seriously your duty toward your friends, your family, and so on and so forth. I mean, the Stoics were pretty big on duty.
Yeah.
You know, Immanuel Kant, who was definitely not a Stoic, but he got his concept of duty from the Stoics. It was influenced, like many other philosophers, he was influenced by the Stoics. And the Stoics took duty seriously, duty toward a number of different players. You have duties toward your friends. You have duties toward your family, of course. You have duty toward your country or your fellow human beings in general. I mean, one of the things that is interesting about the Stoics is that they were among the very first philosophers to espouse the idea of cosmopolitanism, which literally means being a citizen of the world.
Yeah.
So they made a habit of going around, you know, when people were asking them, you know, where are you from? They would not say, you know, I'm from Rome or from Athens or whatever. They would say, I'm from the world. I'm a citizen of the world. In fact, one of the second century Stoics, Heraclitus, actually counsels his students to go around addressing strangers as brothers and sisters or aunts and uncles in order to remind themselves that these are fellow human beings and that they're just as important and you should be concerned about them, and just as if they were actually members of your family.
Yeah. So I wanted to come back around finally to some of the practical spiritual exercises you write about in the book.
Right.
You know, keeping in mind these basic Stoic principles, which you really lay out in the book, the idea of virtue being the highest good and everything else is indifferent, the idea of following nature, that's important. We already talked about the dichotomy of control, but I wanted to go through a few of these and just have you briefly say a few things about them. One thing, I'll just sort of go randomly here. How can I use virtue here and now? Say something about that.
Yeah, that particular phrase is actually very rich because it embodies two different concepts, virtue and sort of the here and now.
Yeah.
Virtue, so the Stoics thought that the most important thing in life is to be virtuous, but But with that term, they didn't mean, you know, today if you hear the word virtue, you think about mostly the Christian virtues, you know, faith, hope, and charity. But they were talking about the so-called four cardinal virtues, which, by the way, Thomas Aquinas, who was, of course, a Christian theologian, actually did incorporate into Christianity. One of the reasons a lot of this stuff that we've been talking about actually sounds familiar, such as like the dichotomy of control. The dichotomy of control, if you think about it, is pretty much the same concept as expressed in the Serenity Prayer, which is a modern Christian prayer, you know, used in 12-step organizations. It's the same idea. But the four fundamental virtues, four cardinal virtues, are practical wisdom, which is the ability to navigate complex moral situations in the best possible way, not in the ideal way, but in the best way that is made possible by the situation. Courage, which is not as much physical courage, but the courage to stand up for the right thing, for whatever happens, you know, that it's the right thing to happen. The related virtue of justice. Justice tells you how to treat other people. You want to treat other people as human beings, as you would like to be treated by them. And then finally, temperance, which is a virtue that focuses on self-control, meaning that you want to do things in proportion to whatever the situation requires. Now, that phrase that you just mentioned, you know, practice virtue in the here and now. How do I practice virtue in the here and now? The second part, the here and now, comes out of the idea that the Stoics thought that there is not much point in dwelling into the past because the past is outside of your control. It has already happened. So if you dwell on the past, you're violating, you know, you're not taking seriously the dichotomy of control. That doesn't mean not learning from your past mistakes. Sure, you can learn from it. But dwelling on, you know, brooding and you know, regretting and that sort of stuff, these are all negative emotions that they have no value for the Stoics because you're obsessing about something you can't do anything about. Well, what about the future? Well, the future is not here yet, and so you don't control that either. In fact, the best way to get the best future possible is, in fact, to be focused on what you're doing right here, right now.
Yeah.
And for the Stoics, in terms of both your life and sort of humanity in general, the best thing you can do right here, right now, is to practice the four virtues, to ask yourself in any particular situation, what is the courageous thing to do? What is the just thing to do? At what level I'm supposed to do it, so temperance, and what is the best trade-off that I can get out of this particular situation, practical wisdom.
Say something about this one, speak little and well. I really liked that.
That's difficult for me to practice. You know, as a philosopher and as a university professor, it's like, that's a tough one. What they mean is that when you are in society, in conversation, you should try to do two things. To speak little, meaning not to overwhelm your fellow, you know, friends or human beings. I mean, nobody likes really somebody who talks a lot and manipulates and monopolizes the conversation. Just try to pay attention more than actually speak. Speak when it is required, when you have actually something to say that contributes to the conversation. And the other thing that's a related exercise is speak well, meaning say something that's actually useful, that's actually contributing to the conversation in a good way, that it's enhancing the conversation as opposed to, for instance, saying something mean or gossiping. The Stoics were definitely not into gossiping.
Yeah.
Because, you know, gossiping is talking badly about other people who are not here to defend themselves. You know, it's just not virtuous.
Let's end with Seneca. I loved this. The spirit ought to be brought up for examination daily. And then I'll just conflate or distill this great section you have of his. And he says, a good man delights in receiving advice. All the worst men are the most impatient of guidance. So this idea of be willing to examine, this seems like an important tenet finally to come up with. Be willing to be flexible and be willing to evolve in your thinking and be transparent and open and be willing to examine yourself, I guess.
That's right. That's one of my favorite exercises, and I do it every day. The idea is to, before you go to bed, you retire in a quiet corner of your house or apartment, and you focus a minute on what you did during the day, and you ask yourself these three questions. What did I do right? What did I do wrong? And what could I have done better? And what did I do right? Because, you know, if you did something right, well, pat yourself on the back. And you learn from positive experiences as well, not just from the negative ones. What did I do wrong? The idea there is, again, not to indulge in regret or in self-flagellation or anything like that. It's just to say, okay, I did that. That was not a good thing. So let's try to avoid that in the future. And you learn from your experiences. And then the third one is, what could I have done better or differently? That one comes out because, you know, a lot of our life is actually about similar situations repeating over and over. You know, we tend to deal with the same colleagues, the same friends, the same students, and so on and so forth, in very similar situations. And so, you know, the first time or the second time you make a mistake and you say, oh, all right, I learned from the mistake. But learning from a mistake doesn't just mean recognizing you made a mistake. It also means asking yourself, what could I do better next time? I reacted badly this time. Maybe I lost my patience. Maybe I started yelling at somebody. Well, what could I do the next time to avoid that sort of thing happening again? And it's a way of preparing yourself, of projecting your mind into the future and preparing yourself to be a better self. Stoicism really is about self-improvement in a sense, which is why it's very popular these days with, you know, football coaches and Silicon Valley and things like that. Yeah. But the idea that a lot of people tend to forget is that it is self-improvement in the service of society. Mm. Again, the Stoics were cosmopolitan. One of their virtues was justice. So you improve yourself because you want to be a better member of society, because you want to make this a better place for everybody to live, of course, including you.
That's Massimo Piliucci. His latest book is called How to Be a Stoic, Using Ancient Philosophy to Live a Modern Life. He also blogs at platofootnote.org and howtobeastoic.org. We have a link to those on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.